Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilik, and Sujit Mello, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 174, being recorded on the 12th of April, 2017, with special guest
Steve Michelotti.
I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Evan and our special guest. Kale, unfortunately, was just getting back from a flight at this time, so he wasn't able to join us on the call, but I think we've got enough people over here to make it a good show, so let's get right to it. There's, as usual, there's a round of updates that the guys have put in the show notes, and Evan, I'll let you talk about the SQL Data Warehouse and Visual Studio Code update.
Yeah, so I think we talked about Visual Studio Code just kind of in passing before, right? This is the really lightweight multi-platform IDE that we've been working on. And I personally have been really happy with it. I do a bunch of my PowerShell stuff in it, and I did some of my ARM templates in it. But I didn't even know that there was a SQL Server extension for it, and found out just yesterday that we have launched, and this is really timely because we talked about SQL Data Warehouse last week, but there is a, now you can do SQL Data Warehouse queries right within Visual Studio Code. Right, you know, Management Studio is really powerful, right? There's some third-party tools that are really powerful, but with that power kind of comes some overhead, and Visual Studio Code's great for just going in and doing something real quick. Plus, you can do pretty hefty stuff in it, so pretty cool.
Great. Thanks for that, yeah. And I'll pick up another one. I'm from India originally, and so there's an update for Azure India this week. So I'll just quickly talk about that. It's apparently grown pretty well, the Azure footprint in India. They have three regions in India alone, West India, which is in Mumbai, Central India in Pune, and South India in Chennai. And there's a lot of leading companies in India, including Tata Motors and Flipkart, which is kind of like the Amazon of India, that have used Azure as their backbone. And so there's a lot of stuff that's going on there. But the key update for India was, in the past, I think, the India data centers or regions were only available for Indian companies, and now they're open to anybody that wants to host their data center there. So if you're targeting people in that area and you want to have some of your services run there, you can actually run it in Azure India. So that's something that's kind of new this week.
I don't know. I don't know the backstory to that, but we did that with the Australian data center as well, right? It started out as just limited to that region, then it's been expanded. But yeah, it's always good to have extra locations around the world that you can deploy your stuff to.
So a lot of the locations out of the U.S., like in Germany and Europe and in Asia, many of them were originally created because of sovereignty laws, right? The data sovereignty laws requiring that companies do, host their products or their services in the same country. And so we had to install these regional data centers or regions. And now they just opened up to anybody that wants to use them. You know, I think originally it was just limited to that because that's the reason we put it there. You know, we didn't have all the services. We didn't have enough capacity, et cetera. But now it's kind of all over the place. And there's another update here, which is the new integrated portal for Azure Functions. Evan, do you want to chat about that?
We talked about Azure Functions, a little bit. I can't remember when, maybe a couple, 3 months ago. And really, this is about continuing to expand the presence in the Azure portal and integrating the Azure Functions with the other services that it interacts with. Right, some of the web app stuff and the like, right? It's just kind of bringing it more to one place rather than you having to make it's an easier management experience.
Yeah, I think it includes all of Azure Functions. All the Azure Functions now are all put in one place, so it's easier to manage them and to get to the property. I think originally you would kind of had to go to a different blade to manage them, and now it's all kind of in that one unified workspace.
Yep.
Okay, great. So that's kind of the it's kind of a light week, I guess. Those were kind of the updates for this week. Let's just jump to our special guest, Steve. And Steve, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Please give our listeners a little bit of background about yourself, and then we can dive into some details.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. So I'm Steve Michelotti, and I am on the Azure Government Engineering team at Microsoft. And I have a developer background, and my primary role on the Azure Gov team is for developer enablement, making sure developers have a good experience on Azure Government, as well as just general, education and also solutioning with our customers so they understand not only what Azure Government is, but also how they can use it in the most optimal way.
And we've kind of had Aaron Barth in the past on talk about Azure Government a while ago, maybe more than a year ago. But I think you were saying that there's been some tremendous updates in the Azure Gov space of late. And so can you kind of maybe give us a flavor as to what's been happening there? What's the current buzz in that space?
Absolutely. And I feel like I always feel obligated to, anytime I talk about Azure Government, to never make the assumption that my listeners know what Azure Government even is. So it might be good to take 60 seconds, even before I get into what's new, to just kind of give a high level on what Azure Government is, because
Good idea.
it has been a while since you had Aaron on. So I think the main thing to know is that Azure Government is a sovereign cloud, which means it's its own distinct instance of Azure. And this is an instance of Azure that's only available to U.S. government only. So that might be federal government, it might be state and local, public sector. So we don't just let anyone into the cloud and into this cloud. And the another important thing to understand is that Azure government has its own distinct data centers. And these are completely isolated data centers from the rest of Azure Commercial. The data centers are isolated. The network is isolated, our express routes are isolated. And so, you talk about data sovereignty laws and, the data always stays within the continental United States. But this is that idea, but on steroids, because it doesn't even share anything with our commercial Azure infrastructure. So that's like a really important thing to grasp. And even the data centers are operated only by screened U.S. persons, and that's one of the things that enables us to have a higher level of compliance and certifications in Azure Government versus Azure Commercial.
That's true for support as well, right? So we've got some restrictions and requirements on who can actually provide support in those for customers who are working in those environments as well. Because I know some of my colleagues and the team that I was on previously, right? We had to there's some certifications that we had to go through to provide that support. When the operations teams need help and the like, and customers need help.
Absolutely. I mean, they're very tight controls around that so that everything stays in compliance with all the certifications. So, in terms of some of the things that are new, since we're talking about some of the data center issues and infrastructure, I'll start there. A year ago, you were probably talking about the fact that we had two data centers, and one was in Virginia and one was in Iowa. Now we have six data centers coming online. So we, of course, have the two original ones, Virginia and Iowa. And then we had two additional data centers that were added in the last, let's say, 6 months, similar regions, east and central. But these two data centers are special in that they are what we call our DoD data centers, so Department of Defense. These have even a higher level of certification. In fact, we got DISA Level 5 certification for those two regions. And that's significant because we're the only publicly available government cloud that has a certification that high. Level 5 is like the highest level of certification you can get for unclassified workloads. So that's really important to us that enables a whole host of customer scenarios that weren't available before, meaning, some of the three-letter agencies can now deploy their workloads on the DoD regions where they couldn't before because it wouldn't have been in compliance. And then in addition to, oh, go
was
ahead.
going to say, Steve, just to make sure I understand this. So what you're saying is, you've got kind of, I don't want to call it, but I guess we'll call it that. We've got vanilla Azure, right, which is commercial public Azure.
Yep.
We've got Azure Government, which adds a layer of isolation and compliance on top of that, and then we've got the DoD variant of Azure Government, which is yet another layer
Correct.
of restriction, isolation, and compliance.
That's exactly correct. And sometimes when people hear about, oh, I have these multiple layers of security and compliance, so is the technology different on Azure Government than Azure Commercial? And the answer is no. You don't really want to think about it in terms of the technology being different. I heard a number the other day that Microsoft spends $1 billion a year investing in security, and that's benefit that all of Azure gets, not just Azure Commercial, not just Azure Government. All of Azure gets the benefit of that. The main difference is how these things are laid out physically. I mentioned one aspect, which is the people working in the data center are screened U.S. persons. Then when you go to the next level for the DoD data centers, that has to do with how the data is physically stored in the data centers. And, you know, if you have a DoD workload, it cannot be stored in the same, you know, in the same data center on the same rack with, let's say, a Fed Civ lower classification workload. So those are some of the differences. But from a technology standpoint, you can think of those as being the same.
Yeah, because, I mean, it is, at the end of the day, and this is true for all of our environments, this is the same code that's running everywhere, right?
Exactly.
I mean, we may have some things to layer on top, like I know the ExpressRoute onboarding experience in Azure Government is not quite as smooth as in the commercial yet, because there is some extra manual steps intentionally, right?
Yeah.
Because we need to add in this compliance and this isolation. But
once it's
connected, it's the same, right? It acts the same, works the same code.
But it's not
correct.
The same code level, right? Didn't Aaron tell us that they were always a little behind because of the extra certification that has to every patch or every release has to go through?
So let's get to that in turn. Two separate things here. You're right. So the first question is about the onboarding experience, and you're absolutely right. Not just for ExpressRoute, but even for getting an Azure subscription, we have a vetting process. So we intentionally make it a little bit more difficult to get a subscription on Azure Government than, you know, you can't just swipe your credit card like you can on Azure Commercial, because we do a lightweight vetting process to make sure that, yes, you are a government entity or affiliated, like maybe you're a partner doing work on behalf of a government entity with a contract in place. So point one on that. Point two is, it depends on, you asked the question on, is it the same code? Maybe it's the same code, but different versions. The answer is that it depends on what service you're talking about. For some services, yes, we're running the exact same code as Azure Public. For other services, maybe we might be a version behind. For other services, maybe we're running the exact same code, but we don't have 100% of all the features enabled. So for example, Azure web apps, good example there. We're basically running the latest and greatest on many of the features, but we, for example, don't have auto scaling is not in place. So it's not that we are like seven versions behind on the code. It's that maybe not every aspect of a particular service got deployed. So it really depends on what service you're talking about.
My experience with that is that most of that is driven by the fact that there is, and this is not unsurprising, but there's a ton of cross dependencies, right, on some of this stuff.
Exactly,
right?
Correct.
And so it really isn't. Sometimes it's, you know, like you were talking about the onboarding, it's a very intentional difference. Others, it's because we're waiting on other dependencies. But really, the drive and the vision is to keep this stuff aligned and as close to, you know, equivalent as we can, because the scope of what we have out there has continued to grow very, very fast.
Absolutely, and we should talk about the specifics a little bit of that. But you're absolutely right. Some people think, why don't you have 100% parity with Azure Public? Well, it's not a trivial piece of engineering to get all of the moving parts for all these different services and get them through certification process and deploy them to Gov. So, but we have made significant strides. You know, if you look at Azure Government a year ago, I would say that it wasn't exactly an inspiring experience for a developer. So I'm a developer, so I constantly look at things through a developer lens. But if you look at what we have now, it's a completely different landscape. A lot of that is due to the fact that we now have ARM. A year ago, it was the older ASM. Now we have Azure Resource Manager. We have the new portal. And we have a whole slew of services that have come online. So we now have HD Insight. We have Power BI. We have Cognitive Services that is now in private preview. Even things like, yes, we have web apps, but we have web apps with VNet integration. And even the VNets are richer now because we have NSGs. We have OMS, and so we have lots of course, we now have blockchain. It's too bad Kale's not here, because he would
he would be happy to hear that, right?
I've actually traded some emails with him about blockchain. So, and we have many state governments that are starting to look at blockchain. So it's interesting. You know, we have Service Fabric that's now in Azure Government, VM Scale Set. So, I mean, the list really goes on. about what has the services that we now have in Azure Gov. And I think the other aspect is not only have we brought a slew of services on, but we've also done a lot in the last several months to make that experience better for developers. One great example of that is our documentation. A year ago, I would think it's probably best to describe the documentation for Azure Gov as frustrating. It was difficult to understand how to get started or what was available. So one step in that is we are now on the GitHub documentation along with the rest of Azure.com. So that was a step in the right direction. But in addition to that, we really revamped how the information is laid out. It makes it much The getting started aspect is much clearer now. Like even the basics, like how you connect to the portal, like a lot of people didn't realize that, oh, the portal actually has a different URL because they're different physical endpoints. How you connect to Azure Government with PowerShell or the CLI or even Visual Studio, those are different for Azure Gov. So a lot of the things... Go ahead.
Yes, Steve, so I'm a developer too, and I find it interesting that you say that developers have to be more think differently when it comes to Azure Gov. You mentioned some of the, you know, the initial portal things, but what about actual writing, like, you know, a web app or a web service or HD Insight? Are there different things? Is there a different API set with Azure Gov that they have to think about?
Okay, this is a great question. So I don't want developers to have the mindset that I have to think about Azure Gov differently. In fact, I want them to have the mindset that if I'm an Azure developer right now on commercial, I can do everything I can do on Azure Government. I'm an Azure Government developer. The only difference is how you connect. Let's use a concrete example. Let's say I'm already very familiar with the C# SDK for working with Azure Storage. The only difference is how you connect. So when you, you know, do your constructor for instantiating a new storage account, you just have to use this other constructor you may not have been aware of where you pass in the endpoint suffix and it's like usgovcloudapi.net. Once you do that one line of code differently, all your code is exactly the same. So it's always you have to connect differently to Azure Gov, but all the code you write is 100% identical, same SDKs, same everything. You add your NuGet packages for your SDKs, the exact same SDKs that you would for regular commercial Azure. It's just that your one line of code typically in your constructor for how you connect to these services is different because we have different endpoints. It's like different physical data centers, isolated. So that's another point to bring that home, which is we do have our own distinct endpoints.
And that's good. But what about the actual, like you mentioned storage, right? The storage endpoint. I think what you've been saying is that the government cloud has certain requirements for data storage. Is there not something that developers have to do when saving data, that they have to be careful about what they're saving or encrypt it in a particular way? Is there something like that?
Okay. So let's separate that question into two parts. One is, as a developer writing code, do I have to do anything differently? And the answer is nope, nothing different other than the constructor I mentioned to connect. As far as I, as a developer writing code, I don't do anything differently. The second aspect is, well, do I have to do encryption to be in compliance? And yes, there are some things you have to think about there. So for example, storage is a good example. You have to make sure to turn on encryption. And you kind of alluded to that already. And that just goes to kind of broader compliance in general. And that actually leads to another interesting point, which is, you know, are you doing infrastructure as a service or platform as a service? Because your responsibility as a developer for compliance changes based on what kind of services you're using. And that's a misconception anyway. A lot of times people think, oh, I'm deploying to Azure Gov. I'm automatically compliant. My app is compliant. Well, no, not exactly. Deploying on a –
go ahead, Steve.
Well, I was just going to say you're deploying on a compliant infrastructure, but you as a developer still have responsibility to make sure you are writing your app in a compliant way.
I was going to say that's actually no different in the commercial cloud. I mean, I can't remember it's been a little while. I've been out of the developer space for a while, but, you know, even in the developer space, we'd have people say, hey, my SQL Azure database, I dropped an entire table.
Yeah.
You did, or your performance is not good. Now, we're layering that stuff in right over time, but it isn't at the end of the day, you're still responsible in IaaS VMs for your app and the OS, right? For platform services, you're still responsible for your, I guess, the integrity of your data. Like, we'll make sure your data doesn't get lost, But if you change your data in a way that you don't want, not every service has a rollback feature.
Exactly, exactly. And that is a big difference. I mean, from a compliance standpoint, if you're deploying on-prem, you've got to worry about everything. I mean, there's like you have to worry about your application and the data and the runtime and the OS and how you're doing your servers and networking and the data center itself. Well, just by moving to the cloud, just using IaaS, infrastructure as a service, virtualization, servers, storage, networking, data center, all that's taken care of for you by Microsoft. Now, you still have to worry about the OS and middleware and what runtime you're using and your data and your application, but just by moving to IaaS, it cuts your responsibility in half from a compliance perspective. Now, if you go to the next step, which is platform as a service, well, now the runtime, middleware, and the operating system, even that is taken care of by Microsoft. So the amount of surface area of your responsibility as a developer for compliance is now really focused on the application and the data. So just for moving, you know, we talk about the benefits from a technology perspective between PaaS and IaaS, but even from a compliance perspective, that's also quite important.
But it's almost like what we've done with Azure Government, right, to your point about moving up the, you know, kind of having less to worry about, right? Like you were saying, if you were doing this on-premises, you would have to go get all those compliances, right?
Yeah,
if you had your own data
center. Exactly right.
Yeah, in this case, again, we're removing that away from you.
And to a certain extent, that's also true for commercial. I mean, I don't want to necessarily have to worry about patching my OS all the time on commercial, too. It's just that on the government space, it's even more important because the compliance gets brought into it.
I just want to kind of elaborate a little bit of what Steve was just saying, because I'm facing that similar thing at one of my current customers. So people think that, okay, you know, the stack, the IaaS stack or the PaaS stack you're getting is compliant, you know, whatever kind of compliance they need, PCI or other compliance. But it's important to think that when you put your application on there, that has to be also PCI compliant. You know, just because everything underneath is PCI compliant doesn't make your application automatically PCI compliant.
Correct.
You have to take a lot of care, and people make that initial mistake of thinking, it's on PCI compliant system. It must be PCI compliant or whatever compliance, you know.
Exactly. And we try to give as much guidance as possible. So, for example, many people are familiar with the GitHub Quick Start templates, the ARM templates. We have put a number of templates in there that where instead of you just get the blue deploy to Azure button, there's a blue deploy to Azure Government button. And we've turned on some things in those ARM templates for best practices, like, for example, encrypting storage or turning on SQL database encryption, or, you know, provisioning your VNets and subnets to make sure you're doing that in a compliant way. So we try to give that type of guidance. And we also have something called the Azure Blueprint. And what this does is helps developers streamline the process of getting their app through certification. Because, I mean, I know as a developer, my eyes will start to glaze over if I start looking at this, you know, hundreds of pages of compliance requirements, and that's not what I want to spend my time doing. But the Azure Blueprint is one of the tools we give to help really streamline that process and significantly reduce the amount of time it takes you to get your app through certification.
So, when you look at that blueprint, is that actually kind of a walkthrough, or does it actually allow you to? Is it more like the resource health type feature where it'll check things for you?
You can think of it sort of like a checklist.
Okay.
These are the things you got. Did you remember to turn on encryption for SQL Server and that sort of thing?
So, kind of boiling it down to, hey, here's the important stuff you need to be thinking about, rather than trying to parse that out of the specifications and the compliance.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Which is very useful.
Yes, definitely.
Now, Steve, you know, moving to say more to the administration side of things with all the resources that are out there in Azure Gov, I'm not a you know, public sector expert, but I do seem to recall that they have different like roles and responsibilities in the public sector space. No, in terms of who can do what, and you know, how does that boil down to, you know, RBAC models or whatever that you use in Azure?
You mean just in terms of different certification process and that sort of thing?
No, in terms of operations, you know, the operations people that are going to be operating, you know, now you've got an application out there, but now it has to be, you know, you're going to have people operating on it, who can touch what, you know, the who's allowed to maybe look at a log, or who's allowed to maybe, you know, connect to administer a database. Is that something that is handled separately by AzureCub, or is that just, you know, a document that says this is a checklist to make sure things are done the correct way?
So from a data center standpoint, it does go back to the fact that, number one, like I said before, the screened U.S. persons, but also if for some reason we have to have someone take a look at something, you know, they are literally only certain people can access it. So it might have to be that, you know, only the person that's, you know, allowed to access that resource can actually touch the keyboard or anything like that. But from a higher level standpoint, from an operation standpoint, from an application I'm deploying, if I'm an agency deploying an app, I'm really going to be concerned with my app. I'm going to let Microsoft worry about, you know, the infrastructure and that sort of thing. But, you know, if I'm SLG, which is state and local government, I probably care about CGIS agreements, the CGIS requirements. If I'm DOD, I probably care about DISA. So, and those certifications have different requirements. So from an application developer perspective, I'm just going to, and we have a blueprint for each one. Here's the Azure blueprint for DISA level 4. Here's one for DISA level 5. So depending on what your requirement is, we can help you through that certification process. And, you know, you mentioned what's the difference between state and local versus federal. It probably has to do with what certification you're going for, and we can kind of customize our guidance appropriately for it.
That's good. Thank you. Yeah. So what are the new things that what else is new in the AzureCub space that you can that you haven't covered already?
So one thing I just briefly mentioned, but I should probably talk a little bit about that I get really excited about is cognitive services, because you can imagine from a government perspective, there's many things in here that many of our customers are quite interested in, and these are things like facial recognition and text translation and speech translation and speaker recognition and the computer vision API, which can look at an image and pick out, oh, there's a fire truck, there's a police car, maybe something's happening. And so, you know, we really have a lot of customers interested in, I mean, this is really compelling technology to be able to essentially create a database, let's say, of known individuals, and you can collect metadata there. It's for facial recognition and speaker recognition and that sort of thing. And I just feel like that technology really lends itself to so many different scenarios, and it's when you start combining the different APIs together to build a cohesive solution, that's when it really starts getting powerful. So that's one area that we've been getting a lot of interest in.
Okay. And the government, all these agencies, like what are they asking for? You know, over and above what you already have deployed in AzureGov, like what are the asks from their side?
In terms of stuff that they still want, or in terms of stuff that we have that they're interested in using right now?
Either way, you know, stuff that's not yet in AzureGov maybe, or stuff that it doesn't exist, but it's special to the to public sector that they would like to see.
You know, I think here's the interesting part about it. We're so much closer to parity right now against Azure Commercial that, you know, a year ago it might have been, hey, here's my list of things I want to have in AzureGov. But right now, the number of things we have in AzureGov is so much far beyond where it was. There's not a ton of, hey, I wish you had this feature. You don't have it in Gov, but you do have it in Commercial. You know, those conversations were much more frequent a year ago. Sure, there's a few things we don't have, but we feel pretty good about where our parity is. And, of course, that continues to grow every day. What I kind of see more so often is a lot of these agencies are looking for guidance on how to use the cloud. They maybe they've been given a directive, your job is to move your applications to the cloud. And they think, well, I don't really, what does that mean? What does that mean to move to the cloud? So what happens a lot of times is, okay, I guess I'm just going to spin up a bunch of VMs and move my stuff over. That's the canonical lift and shift. And you can do that, and you can do that in many clouds, and you can certainly, we feel good about our IaaS, and you can certainly lift and shift your workloads over there. But then what happens is they do this lift and shift, and they start looking around at their VMs, and they've got all these applications deployed all over the place, and the VMs might be sitting there at 1% CPU. They got 100 VMs, and they're all sitting at 1% CPU, and they're not really using their resources efficiently. And so that's where you start getting into, how can we help you do some architecting and solutioning of your application to update your architecture and modernize it for the cloud era? How can you start using more of these PaaS services to use your resources more effectively? We have these technologies now like Service Fabric, which allows you to control the density of how your applications are provisioned on, across various VMs. We now have open source capabilities like Docker that allow you to do the same sort of thing. And we support it all. So a lot of times it's just maybe you don't need 100 servers. Maybe you need 30 or maybe you need 50, but you need to make better use of those servers so they're actually using CPU, and that's how you're going to save money. You know, a lot of the directive is how can you save taxpayer dollars? Well, a lot of the way to do that is to use your resources more effectively, and that's a lot of the things I see as us helping a lot of these agencies do.
So that you know, especially this time of year as we all get ready to pay our taxes if we haven't paid them, we want to see them use cloud so we save money, right? That's our extra goal. By the way, you made me very happy with mentioning Service Fabric.
You did, yes. Thank you. And Evan, why did you have to ruin the fun by mentioning taxes? I have no idea. But that's good, Steve. Obviously, as a you know, when I first started on Azure, I was able to just walk up to the portal and spin up a free trial account and get kind of comfortable with it. What's the equivalent experience for an agency out there that wants to kick the tires on Azure? How do they go about doing that?
Absolutely. So what you would do is you would go to azure.com/gov, G-O-V, and that's our homepage. And right from that page, you'll see a big button that says request a free trial. And once you do that, like I said, there's a lightweight vetting process. We just take some information to make sure you're who you say you are. You know, it might be 24, 48 hours, a couple days, no big deal. And then, boom, you're up and running with a free trial. And if any major questions come up, we do a more hands-on onboarding experience in Azure Gov because we want to make sure these agencies – compared to commercial where you're just swiping your credit card, you're not going to have any interaction with anyone, just go. In Azure Gov, we're making sure, if you have questions during the onboarding process, we want to be there to answer them. But, yeah, you can just go to azure.com/gov, request a free trial, and you're up and running within a couple days of us giving you the green light.
That's good. That's very good. Thank you. Well, I think this has been a good roundup on all the latest in the Azure Gov space. I really thank Steve for giving us that. Evan, anything more for Steve?
Yeah, no, this was great. As always, I picked up some things as well as far as the status of Azure Government. So.
Great. Thanks Evan, for having me on.
Evan, do you ever get any cases on Azure Gov, or is that a separate team that supports it?
So it's a mix. It kind of depends a little bit on the part of the technology and kind of the current state of the business. We've kind of morphed a little bit over the years as the product has grown, right? Obviously, you support it differently with small versus large. But I have absolutely in worked a number of Azure Government cases, and actually some of the early on, I don't know, Steve, if you're ever involved in some of the early on Express Route onboarding cases, customers and the guilty parties will remain nameless. I spent a number of nights up a long time trying to, get some of that working as we're, again, working out some of the early kinks. So we definitely see them. I know some folks that do nothing but Azure Government, and then a number of folks that, will act as consults or escalation points, for assistance with, because at the end of the day, it's the same stuff, right? And it's really hard to keep up to date, just like in commercial, on everything that's there, everything that works, how it works, how it interacts, and all the tooling and the like.
Yeah, great. No, that's good. Thanks, Evan. All right, Steve, again, thanks. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us and giving us an update on Azure Gov.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle at Azure Podcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.